We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip. When it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Arr, fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
In state and local government, tech upgrades aren't optional. They're essential. Whether it's improving digital services, protecting public data, or modernizing outdated systems, the demand for skilled IT professionals has never been higher. CBT Nuggets helps you stay ahead with affordable, on-demand IT training that's built for your schedule. Our short, practical videos and hands-on virtual labs make it easy to build real-world skills in networking, cybersecurity, cloud technologies, and more. You don't need expensive hardware or complicated setups, just a browser and the motivation to grow. Whether you're an IT admin, public service tech, or new to the field, CBT Nuggets gives you the tools to better support your team and your community. And with new content added regularly, there's always something relevant to learn. Join thousands of learners who are upgrading their skills and advancing their careers. Start your 7-day free trial today at cbtnuggets.com. Because smarter tech skills don't just help you, they help your whole community succeed.
Let's find a conversation between your soul. Let's conversation between your soul and the night.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison, and we are very excited to bring you the news. But before we do, we've got some quick announcements, quick request, maybe. So this week, we've got a very special guest. I think, Derek, we could drop it at this time. Francis Fukuyama is making his first appearance, but probably not the last. Hopefully not the last.
Hopefully not the last. I don't know. It depends Prestige. On how much we annoyed him.
Yeah, he seemed to be only slightly annoyed. But no, you'll all have to listen for that. That will be our bonus episode on Sunday. And beyond Fukuyama, Derek, I think it's fair to say we've got some really interesting guests coming up in the next few weeks for our bonus episodes. So if you haven't yet subscribed, please consider subscribing to the podcast. We really can't do it without you. We need your support and resources to get this thing going. So if you haven't yet, please subscribe at AmericanPrestigePod.com. Also, if you subscribe at the level of $60 or up, you get a free one-year digital subscription to The Nation magazine. So if you'd like to help us out that way, please consider subscribing at the level of $60 or more. Beyond that, we've also got a few announcements. So things are coming. We've got beautiful new artwork that we really can't wait to show you. It's in the vein of our logo, but kind of takes it in a new and I think interesting and cool direction. We'll be debuting that soon. And we've also got a new website coming, which will look better than our current website, but beyond looking better, will allow everyone to easily search our vast archive. And one of the things that I think is cool about the show is that a lot of the stuff kind of just works forever. We've got a bunch of interviews with authors. We've got deep dives into various subjects like the history of currency, the history of Vietnam, of course, the history of Palestine. And so we're hoping that this website will allow you to really look through our vast archive of episodes that don't really have a time limit on them, and you can kind of listen to them forever. And then finally, this request that I'd like to do is to ask everyone, if you haven't yet, to review the podcast on Apple. We're at about like 720, I think, reviews, but if we could really break 1,000, that actually helps the show. It puts it in people's feeds, well, maybe not their feeds, it puts it on their radar, and the algorithm really does help. And so we understand that not everyone has the financial resources, especially during what is going to be a difficult moment, to subscribe. But one thing that you can do if you listen to this podcast is to review it, hopefully positively, on Apple. That really does help us. So thank you very much. for listening to that. And Derek, why don't we now get into the news? And why don't we start with Ukraine, where the peace talks have unfortunately collapsed.
Right. So there was a peace talk, as people probably know, peace talks were scheduled for Friday in Istanbul. There was the big flurry of activity last week where Putin suggested that they have direct peace talks for the first time since 2022. And Volodymyr Zelensky, he did that to get out of what was likely a new wave of sanctions coming, which, who knows whether they would have come or not. But Putin suggested the peace talks as an alternative to new Russia sanctions. And Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, accepted and then kind of tried to raise the stakes by saying, I'm going to be there personally, and I challenge you, Vladimir Putin, to show up and we can sit across the table from one another and talk. And of course, as I think we talked about last week, Putin did not show up, so was not attended by a very high level delegation. Zelensky didn't go. Donald Trump was talking about maybe, you know, stopping by if the other leaders were there, but he obviously didn't waste his time going. And what was left was relatively low level talks between a Russian delegation that seems to have been designed to just sort of show up and not really agree to anything, and a Ukrainian team that was a little bit higher level, but still not most likely, able to make decisions. The talks on that basis, you would expect that they did not go well. They went probably worse than that, worse than you might have expected. They did agree to a large prisoner swap, about 1,000 prisoners on each side, which is not nothing. I don't want to diminish that. But when it came time to talk about a potential ceasefire, the Russians want no part of that. When it came time to talk about what the contours of an eventual peace deal might look like, the Russians made demands that, according to the Ukrainian side, went beyond anything that they've been talking about recently, or certainly anything that Trump and Putin had been talking about. They included full Ukrainian military withdrawal from all of the provinces of Ukraine that Russia claims to have annexed. So not just Crimea, but the four mainland provinces that the Russian military controls partially to one degree or another. But the demand seemed to be that the Ukrainians would give them all up in their entirety and would recognize Russian sovereignty over those provinces, which wasn't in the framework that Trump and Putin had previously discussed. So they really went above and beyond in their demands so high. And, you could say, well, this is a first negotiation. They're trying to, play a little game here. They'll compromise down. But I think they were so intense. These demands were so kind of out of bounds of what's been talked about that they discouraged future talks. There was some discussion of, let's organize a future round. Let's talk. Let's, put down, some of our principles and share those documents with each other. But I don't really think that's going anywhere. The big surprise then, Danny, to kind of skip ahead here.
Skip ahead, Derek.
Skip ahead on our little.
What was that? What was that? Swing Away? Was that from Signs? Remember that? Swing Away.
God, that was so weird.
It was so terrible. Oh yeah, yeah.
More inappropriately than I did at Signs. It was just so hilarious.
Yeah, that was when. Anyway, he fell off. Yeah. Sorry. Irrelevant to go.
So. On Monday, Trump, kind of trying to salvage this, I think, scheduled a phone call with Putin for Monday. And then after that was supposed to brief Zelensky. He and Zelensky had a short phone call prior to that to kind of lay out what they were trying to achieve. And then afterwards, he was supposed to brief Zelensky and several European leaders. The call that he had with the European leaders after this discussion with Putin was apparently, this is according to a number of outlets, but Axios, Barak Ravid at Axios, got some insider leaks from on the call and said, basically that the people he was talking to were stunned by what Trump was saying. He apparently took a lot of Putin's positions in what has a reversal over the last few weeks. People may recall that Trump and Zelensky met on the sidelines of Pope Francis's funeral a few weeks ago. And since then, Trump has seemed to be more kind of positioning himself on the Ukrainian side of things. He was back and had flipped entirely, I guess, back to the Russian point of view. He refused to, flatly refused, I guess, to join any new European sanctions push. The plan had been, I think, depending on how that phone call went, if it went poorly and it didn't, you know, augur for any sort of movement in the peace talks, that they were all going to collectively impose a new round of very harsh sanctions against Russia. Trump rejected that idea out of hand, and essentially seems to have convinced them that he's checked out at this point of the Russia-Ukraine peace process. He's kind of bored with it. He doesn't feel like it's going anywhere. He's frustrated, is the language that the White House has been using. And so he's just kind of, you know, he's decided that this is somebody else's problem. It's Europe's problem, more or less. And so they were left kind of nonplussed as to what to do. And I don't, you know, it's only been a few days since then. I think the plan now is the Ukrainians are going to ask the European Union to take the lead in terms of new sanctions, in terms of really ratcheting up, trying to ratchet up economic pressure on Russia, since, you know, Trump is, as I say, checked out, at least for the moment. I don't see that going anywhere. The Ukrainians have reportedly written up a white paper that they're going to present to the EU and say, you know, this is what you should be doing. But the elements of the white paper would require, as with most other things the EU does, they would require consensus on the part of the 27 EU member states, and they're not going to get that. For things like harsher asset freezes, a transfer of assets, Russian assets to Ukrainian control, you know, harsher sanctions, secondary sanctions, even they were calling for on Russian oil exports. They're not going to get a consensus decision from the EU to do that. The Ukrainians are suggesting that the EU shift from consensus decision making to majority decision making, which would work if they could get to that, but that is a huge lift. I mean, that's a much more fundamental point in terms of how the EU operates. So I really don't see a way forward there. I think we may be at the point of some degree of just stalemate, and things are going to continue on as they have been at this point. There doesn't seem to be a way forward, at least yet. Anything can change, obviously, very quickly. But you know, I don't see it. I don't see an obvious path forward at this point.
That's beautiful, Derek. Anything really can change. Let's get into this European Union election roundup, and let's start with this Romanian centrist who has won the presidency.
There were three elections on Sunday in the EU or in the EU member states that people were watching very closely. The one that was being watched most closely was the presidential election in Romania. You know, I don't want to go through this entire story, but folks may recall that a far-right candidate named Challen Georgescu won the first round of Romania's presidential election late last year. There was supposed to be a runoff in December that he was favored to win, and then Romanian election authorities just up and annulled the whole thing. They claimed that Georgescu had gotten illegitimate help in boosting his public profile from Russia. He was a very Russian-friendly candidate. And so they decided that the whole election was illegitimate, and they scheduled a do-over for May this year, in which the far-right candidate, another far-right candidate named George Simion, sort of took over for Georgescu and won the first round. He headed into the runoff, which was on Sunday, against the mayor of Bucharest, Nicușor Dan. And there was polling was a little bit all over the place, but Don actually wound up winning with a bit under 54% of the vote, I think, was the official count. To some surprise, I mean, you know, most of the polling, I think, had Simion winning this election. It was close. I mean, it was certainly within, you know, the margin of error, but most of it, I think, had him winning. Don, you know, is sort of a sigh of, you know, sort of a, you can hear the sighs of relief in Brussels and European capitals, not to have a pro-Russian, far-right, kind of anti-EU president elected in Romania. So they were happy with that. Simion has challenged the results of the vote, but I think the Romanian Constitutional Court just on Thursday ratified them. So there doesn't seem to be a legal avenue for him to continue on. So, yeah, that's I guess, score one for the EU, however you want to characterize that.
Let's move on to Poland. What happened in good old Poland?
Similarly, the centrist candidate who happens to be the mayor of Warsaw, not that different from Don, I guess, is the mayor of Bucharest, Rafał Trzaskowski, won the first round of Poland's presidential election on Sunday. He did not win the 50% plus one threshold to win an outright victory, but so he will be heading to a runoff against a right-wing candidate, kind of an academic scholar named Karol Nawrocki. Trzaskowski took, I think, a bit under 31% of the vote, so he's got a ways to go to get to a majority, although polling seems to favor him heading into that second round, which will take place on June 1st. Again, an election that I think people across the EU are watching. The Polish presidency is not a hugely powerful office, but it does have some role in Polish politics and can make, if there is a kind of far-right candidate elected there. And Nawrocki is sort of straddles the line, I think, between mainstream conservative and far-right. That could be a headache again for Brussels, so people will be watching that one as well.
Thank you, Derek. Staying within the broader European Union, why don't you tell us what happened in Portugal? It's been a good week for the centrists.
it's been a good week for the centrists. It's been a bad few years for Portuguese politics, though. Portugal has gone through several governments in the last 3 years. I think this was the third election in as many years in Portugal. It was a snap election. It was forced by the collapse of Prime Minister Luis Montenegro's government, which was a minority government. His Democratic Alliance bloc, which is sort of center-right, as you say, kind of centrist, mainstream. It collapsed last year amid a corruption scandal, and given that it was a minority government, it was not hugely stable. Anyway, there was some hope, although polling didn't suggest anything like this, but there was some hope that Portugal could emerge from this election with an actual majority coalition or majority government in place. It did not. The Democratic Alliance in Montenegro won again, but they only control 86 seats in the Assembly of the Republic, which is a 230-seat body. So they will once again have to form a minority government, which is not stable, which will probably not last that long. So any hope of kind of, keeping a government in place for any extended period of time, probably not going to happen. We'll see how it goes. The other thing that people were watching was the performance of the far-right Chega party, which is, along the lines of the people we were talking about in Romania and Poland, anti-EU, hostile to that whole project, part of the wave of right-wing parties that have been surging across Europe of late. They did quite well. They outperformed their polling to finish in second place, tied for second place, I believe, with the Socialist Party at 58 seats each, which is probably going to force Montenegro's government to govern further from the right than it did last time or during its last term. If he wants to get any legislative support to pass anything, given that it's minority status, they will probably have to appeal to Chega, so that gives them some leverage over the course of the new government.
Thanks, Derek. And we'll always keep you updated with European politics, everyone. Let's move on to South Asia for a bit, and let's talk about India, which has continued to threaten Pakistani water levels.
Yes. This is a concerning in a long-term sense. It's not necessarily a short-term issue, but given that the two countries just fought a minor skirmish, at least, over the terrorist attack that took place in Kashmir several weeks ago, the Indian government, in part of its response to that terrorist attack prior to the breakout of the hostilities, suspended the 1960 Indus Waters Treaty, which governs water usage, shared water usage in the Indus Valley. Pakistan gets a large percentage of its water from rivers that flow first through India before they get into the main Indus and kind of flow out to the sea from there. So India, as the upstream party, sort of bound by this treaty to regulate its water usage and make sure that Pakistan has the water that it needs getting, downstream, downriver. But India suspended the treaty, probably not strictly legally. I don't think there's a mechanism in the treaty for one party to suspend its participation, but you know, who's going to stop them at this point? So they suspended their participation in the treaty, and they're talking about, Reuters reported this earlier this week, I think over the weekend, that they are talking about a vast array of new water projects on these upstream rivers that could drastically reduce the level of water flow that gets into Pakistan. None of them is anywhere close to being completed. Some of them, I don't even know if they've been started. And so we're not anywhere close to the point where those water levels would really start to be affected. But it's something that Pakistan has to worry about. And if you talk about, you know, the concept of water wars, which is something that is more and more being looked at as a something we're going to see in the future, thanks to climate change mostly. But this is also one of the considerations, is how countries are able to share water, especially countries that have a history of hostility with one another, like India and Pakistan. So I think this is something really to watch in terms of a potential flashpoint. And any war over water, any conflict between these two countries over water is going to be much more severe than what we saw a couple of weeks ago. Water is existential. And if Pakistani farmers and Pakistani, you know, Pakistani people can't get the water that they need, or there's a threat to the water that they need, then you're going to have a very harsh response, I think, from Pakistan.
Yeah, and South Asia is also one of the places where climate is supposed to really hit first. So we'll definitely be keeping our eye on that. All right, Derek, let's talk about Madamela Ramaphosa, who is a South African president. He visited the White House, and things didn't go that well. So what happened?
You know, I don't think they went that badly for him. Ramaphosa shows up at the White House, showed up at the White House on Wednesday. He came trumpeting, you know, that he was going to repair the relationship between South Africa and the Trump administration, which has been soured for a number of reasons, but mostly, you know, partly because of South Africa's involvement in the International Court of Justice case against Israel, but partly also because Trump has, and, you know, I'm sure fueled by co-president Elon Musk, has crafted this fantasy universe where the white population of South Africa is being oppressed. There's no evidence for this, but, you know, where it's being oppressed, it's being murdered. They're being killed en masse. There's all these kind of online conspiracy theories that Trump is very susceptible to. There's no actual evidence to support any of this stuff, but Trump believes it. And so he's taken some very harsh steps towards South Africa. He's been very critical of South Africa in his first few months back in office. And so Ramaphosa, was heading to Washington ostensibly to try and fix things. And what he got instead was the Zelensky treatment, where you get sat on a couch in the Oval Office and Donald Trump yells at you in front of the press for, you know, 15, 20 minutes. And Trump harangued him about this supposed, you know, horrible treatment of white South Africans. And there was just, I mean, you know, people are probably aware there was just a group of Afrikaners who came to the U.S. as refugees. This is the only population Donald Trump feels is worthy of refugee status in the United States, anywhere in the world. And so, you know, Ramaphosa got harangued, as Zelensky did. He seemed to take it all in stride, and I think he was probably ready for it. I suspect, he had to be, really, because having seen what happened to Zelensky, you have to know you're going in there. This guy doesn't like you very much. He may have another outburst like he did with Zelensky. And so, you know, Ramaphosa just kind of sat there and took it. He pushed back a little, not that much. Later insisted that everything was fine and it was sort of overblown what happened in front of the press. I suspect from his perspective, you know, would he rather have gotten out of D.C. with a trade deal or a deal to restore some U.S. aid to South Africa or, you know, something like that? Sure. But given that he and the African National Congress, his party, have been losing popular support in South Africa, we talked about the election, the recent election, where they lost their majority for the first time since the end of apartheid. Given that, I think it's not a bad thing for him to be seen kind of going into the White House and getting beat up by a man who is not popular in South Africa. Like, he's been very contemptuous of the country. He's been very contemptuous of the people, and they know that. So I think for Ramaphosa, the imagery of that was probably not bad for him politically. And we've already seen, you know, some reporting from South Africa that suggests people were proud of how he handled himself. They're kind of questioning why he went, but I think that's an easy case to make. You say, you know, look, it's economically important to us and the country that I make that trip, but things didn't go right because this guy is a jackass. So nothing I can do about that. I think politically it will probably work out for him.
The best piece of financial advice I've ever received is to pay yourself first. That's why now with every paycheck I receive, I start by putting a little bit away for those rainy days. Today's episode is sponsored by Acorns. Acorns is a financial wellness app that makes it easy to start saving and investing for your future. Acorns lets you get started with the spare money you've got right now, even if all you've got is spare change. You don't need to be an expert. Acorns recommends a diversified portfolio that can help you weather all of the market's ups and downs. Using Acorns, before I knew it, I had a couple $1,000s in a little nest egg account. Sign up now and join the over 14 million all-time customers who have already saved and invested over $25 billion with Acorns. Head to acorns.com/heartbreak or download the Acorns app to get started. Paid non-client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Tier 1 compensation provided. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/heartbreak.
Feel like you're stuck in career limbo? Clock in, clock out, repeat. No growth, no new opportunities. It's time to break out and break into tech. With CBT Nuggets, you can start building the IT skills that companies are hiring for right now. We make training fast, simple, and practical. From networking to cybersecurity, you'll get short, easy-to-watch videos and hands-on virtual labs so you can build real-world skills without expensive gear or complicated setups. For just $59 a month, you get unlimited access to our full training library. That includes certifications, skill-based learning, and practice exams, a $100 value included free. Learn anytime, anywhere, and get job ready on your terms. Thousands have used CBT Nuggets to launch new careers, and you can too. Right now, CBT Nuggets is offering a free trial. Easily find the training you need and test it out with no commitment. Start your 7-day free trial now at cbtnuggets.com. Don't wait. A better job is just a few clicks away.
So, Derek, let's get depressing. Jake, I think you should come up with like a let's get depressing drop that we could use.
I know,
because
that's really not good. No, do not do that.
All right, guys, let's get into it. So let's move on to Israel-Palestine, and let's start with the IDF's Operation Gideon's Chariots. Derek, what's going on?
The operation kicked off over the weekend. The Israelis announced that they had begun what they called extensive ground operations throughout the northern and southern Gaza Strip. They've been doing this for a few days prior to the announcement, which, as I said, came over the weekend. But they've been, you know, ramping up airstrikes, ramping up evacuation orders, forced movement of people out of places, especially in northern Gaza. They also ordered the evacuation of much of Khan Yunis later in the week, ordering people to move to the so-called humanitarian safe zone in Mowassi on the Mediterranean coast. Gideon's Chariots is sort of the I hesitate to use the term I'm going to use, but it's the end game as far as the Israelis are concerned. End game is a good less inflammatory thing to say. What Benjamin Netanyahu wants to do is displace the entire population of Gaza. As we've said before, he wants to displace the entire population of Gaza into a zone that his military has created and flattened in what used to be Rafah in the south. They will be provided there with some degree of humanitarian aid, certainly in an adequate degree based on everything we've seen from the Israelis so far. But the rest of Gaza will be considered occupied militarily by the IDF. It will be presumably a free fire zone. They'll be trying to kill everything that moves. And then the goal is to implement the Donald Trump, let's turn this place into the depopulated Riviera of the Eastern Mediterranean, and get the Palestinians out of there altogether. They would be relocated to who knows where. No country has agreed to take them to participate in what would be a crime against humanity, ethnic cleansing. But that is still what Netanyahu is holding on to, that this is the final solution there I said it, for Gaza, for Israel's conflict with Hamas. That's the plan. We'll see how well it works. The facilities for kind of receiving people in Rafah are not yet constructed. The humanitarian distribution nodes, for example, whatever shelter they plan to give these people in Rafah is not there yet. They're not ready for that part of it, but they are evacuating neighborhoods around Gaza City. They're evacuating parts of Gaza City. As I said, they moved into Khan Yunis. They did some evacuations in central Gaza. They're working their way pretty quickly through the territory and combining these forced evacuation orders and ground operations with some very heavy airstrikes. It's been very violent several days. You hear scores of people killed each day in Gaza by the IDF. So that part of it is continuing. And then there's the humanitarian part, which I think we'll get into here.
Yeah, let's get into this. The Israeli government has allowed minimal aid into Gaza, but there seems to be issues with distribution. So, Eric, tell us what's going on.
So the plan, right, is to, we've talked about this before, the plan is for this Gaza Humanitarian Foundation that the Trump administration has manufactured. We still don't really know who's running it or how it's going to operate. But eventually this foundation is supposed to step in and take over the job of distributing humanitarian aid or getting humanitarian aid into Gaza and then distributing it. But that the foundation isn't going to be ready to start work until at least the end of May. So there's this period of time where the starvation campaign has been going on since early March. So we're at the over two and a half months at this point, since the Israelis just decided to blockade everything getting into Gaza, medicine, food, etc. There's been some growing pressure, and we'll talk about the European countries that have spoken out lamely about what's going on. But there has been some minimal international pressure on Israel to restore some flow of humanitarian aid back into the territory. And so Benjamin Netanyahu's office announced late Sunday that it would begin bringing a minimal level of humanitarian aid back into the territory. On Monday, he gave I think it was a televised address, or his office released a video address, more pitched toward his supporters, who are just adamant that everybody in Gaza should starve to death. But his base is kind of far right base, where he justified his decision to allow what he said was minimal humanitarian aid into Gaza on the basis not of, people are starving to death or this is, inhumane what we're doing to these people, but on the basis of if we don't do this, if we don't give the U.S. and Europe, our European patrons, our American patrons, this kind of fig leaf, this window dressing that, hey, we're not, completely trying to just mass murder these people, they'll stop supporting us. They'll have no choice but to turn on us. And we can't have that. We can't continue this ethnic cleansing operation if we don't have the support of the U.S. and Europe. So I'm doing this just to kind of, throw some window dressing on things and give these countries enough cover that they can justify continuing to support the atrocity that we've got underway. As you said, Danny, there's no evidence. They've brought in, as he said, a minimal amount of aid. There's been about I think the target number is 60 trucks a day coming into Gaza. That is, I mean, it's absurdly beneath what the level of actual demand is. So it's barely even worth talking about. And of the aid that's been brought in so far, there's no evidence that any of it, or at least as of yesterday, there was no evidence that any of it had been distributed to anyone in Gaza. Some of it had been, a very small amount had been transported from the checkpoint, the border checkpoint at Kerem Shalom, to a UN warehouse, but there was no mechanism for distributing it beyond that. Even the transit from the checkpoint to these warehouses is fraught because of the intensity of the IDF bombardment and concerns about safety. So, the actual
second piece of this, which is getting the aid, you know, once you get the aid into the territory, how do you get it to the people who need it? That part seems to be completely, you know, not a consideration at this point. And nothing appears to be happening on that front.
Thank you, Derek. Let's talk about Europe and how Europe has responded to the Israeli government's actions and then also this shooting incident in the West Bank.
So there's this, this reporting, like, I don't really know on what basis at this point anybody tries to report this kind of stuff. But there's this general sense that European countries are getting frustrated with Israel, and there's some kind of tidal wave of backlash coming from Europe that's going to hit Israel over the starvation campaign, over the ethnic cleansing. Like, it's just a bridge too far for European countries. I don't believe that for a second, but a number of countries have, you know, kind of this week, a number of European countries and Canada, I think, joined as well, issued statements about, you know, the inadequacy of the humanitarian project, you know, kind of lambasting Israel for the things it's been doing. And so that, you know, that's part of the pressure, I guess, that motivated Netanyahu to do this very minimal and inadequate aid thing that you know, he's trying to get credit for. But it doesn't go beyond that. There's no indication that any of these governments are actually prepared to do anything substantive. I think the UK sanctioned a few West Bank settlers, which was the same game that the Biden administration played, where they sanctioned some individual West Bank settlers and then called it a day. We're seeing the same thing even with the Trump administration, which is back to the same Biden playbook of doing nothing to actually stop the Israelis from you know, doing what they're doing, but leaking to the press and even leaking to Axios, which was the Biden administration's favorite outlet, how frustrated they are with the Israelis. And, you know, they're really mad at them. And God, gosh, you know, we don't want them to do this stuff. But that's it. You know, that's as far as it goes. We're even at the point where on, as you mentioned, the shooting incident in the, on Wednesday, there was a group of diplomats, many of them European, who were touring the West Bank city of Jenin. Now, Jenin has been the target of Israel's Gaza-like operations in the northern West Bank for several weeks now. It's been badly hit. The refugee camp, I think, has been emptied out at this point. It's been besieged. It's been, you know, very badly treated by the Israelis. And so a group of diplomats were touring the city on Wednesday when a group of IDF personnel fired warning shots, what they said were warning shots, at least, at this group of diplomats. The Israelis claimed that the group had strayed from its approved tour route and they were at risk of entering a dangerous area. And the Israelis were trying to warn them off and drive them back. The IDF actually said it regretted the inconvenience caused by its soldiers firing on diplomats, which is fascinating. And again, the response to what is an egregious act, like opening fire in the vicinity of diplomats in a situation like this, is egregious. The response has been, you know, a few statements from the European Union, from the European Union member states, kind of you know, scolding the Israelis for doing this. A couple of European countries summoned the Israeli ambassadors in their respective capitals to complain. But that's really about it. There is some sort of, I think, collective response being jiggered up, but it's probably just going to be a sternly worded letter. So, you know, all of this is farcical and has been for the last, you know, 19 months or whatever it's been. It just continues to be a joke.
Thank you, Derek. Let's talk about the Israeli military appears to be preparing for strikes against Iran. And then let's talk about the state of these nuclear talks.
This was a big breaking report from CNN on Tuesday that the Israeli government has advanced plans for a military strike on Iranian nuclear facilities. Whether or not it gets the support of the Trump administration, it's unclear to me that they could pull off a strike on Iranian nuclear facilities without U.S. participation. Nevertheless, the point is they're really advancing toward a strike, regardless of what the Trump administration does. And Donald Trump has said he doesn't want the Israelis to carry out a strike like that while he's in the process of negotiating, or his administration is in the process of negotiating on a nuclear deal with the Iranians. But the Israelis are lurching forward with this anyway. I don't know how much to make of this. As I say, it's unclear to me that the Israelis could actually pull it off without U.S. support. So, you know, that they're independently planning it, that probably doesn't mean that much. And you don't know what the motivation is here. You know, it's possible the worst case, I guess, here is that the Israelis are so far along in their planning and so close to ordering a strike that members of the U.S. intelligence community are freaking out and felt the need to leak the plans to the press to try and maybe put a stop to it. But the other consideration here is that the Trump administration is trying to ramp up pressure on the Iranians to make concessions in nuclear talks, and they feel like the prospect of an Israeli strike that could lead to a bigger conflict is one way to do that. And so they're feeding this stuff to the press to kind of send a message to the Iranians. I don't know which. But as you say, Danny, the nuclear talks are continuing. The Omani government announced on Wednesday that there will be a fifth round of talks on Friday. This time will take place in Rome, presumably at the Omani embassy, as they did the last time they were in Rome. Nevertheless, I don't think there's any reason to be optimistic that these talks are going to get somewhere. That they're still talking is a positive sign. But the Trump administration, publicly at least in recent days, has reverted from a more ambiguous position on the future of Iran's uranium enrichment program to going back to just it's very stark. Iran cannot have an enrichment capability. That's it. You know, no room for negotiation. And the Iranians, for them, that's a red line. Something they would probably refuse to do under any circumstances. They've offered some alternative workarounds or possibilities for workarounds, but it doesn't sound like the Trump administration is considering those anymore. And in which case, you know, if that's the case, if they're firmly set in these positions, then this is all going to break down at some point. It's just a matter of time.
Let's move over to Bolivia, where Evo Morales, has been excluded from the presidential ballot.
Tuesday was the deadline for candidates intending to run in Bolivia's presidential election in August. And Morales, the electoral tribunal excluded Evo Morales from the ballot. Morales has several times had the Bolivian Constitutional Court rule against his potential candidacy. Strictly speaking, he is term limited. I mean, he served three of a possible two terms. And was elected to a fourth before the coup in 2019 that forced him out of power. So strictly speaking, from a legal perspective, he is beyond his term limits at this point. So that's the justification. They also questioned the political party that he's formed since he was not going to get the nomination of the Movement for Socialism Party. He had formed another party called Evo Pueblo, under whose ballot line he was supposed to run. They questioned the legitimacy of that party as well in ruling that he could not be on the ballot. The other consideration here, the other interesting thing that took place on Tuesday was the tribunal also rejected the candidacy of Andronico Rodriguez, who's the president of the Bolivian Senate, is closely associated with Morales, and it also filed to run for president in August. Again, they questioned his party support. This is more of a provisional rejection. I think his status could be revisited. The tribunal said it's investigating the institutional support for Rodriguez's candidacy. So potentially, I guess he could be allowed back on the ballot. But this really all works out to the benefit of Luis Arce, the current president of Bolivia, who's not running. In August, he's so unpopular, he kind of saw the writing on the wall and decided to pull himself out of the race. But he's put forward a former minister of government named Eduardo Del Castillo as his preferred candidate. Del Castillo will presumably be the nominee of the Movement for Socialism. And if he's the only quote-unquote leftist on the ballot, as you know, these other candidates are excluded by the authorities, then that gives him a pretty strong position from which to run, even if he's associated with the unpopular Arce. So, you know, some backroom shenanigans may be happening here. I don't know, but it's an interesting thing to keep an eye on.
Thanks, Derek. Let's do a new Cold War update, where China has pledged additional money to the World Health Organization after a pandemic agreement.
New Cold War.
Right. So the United States is, as you likely know, Danny, pulled out of the World Health Organization earlier this year. Was one of the first things Donald Trump did upon resuming office. The U.S. has been the largest contributor to the WHO by far. So it blew a big hole in the WHO's budget and its financial support. The Chinese government announced this week that it would pledge another $500 million to the WHO. And this is China, I think, trying to do something that's not all that costly, not all that labor intensive, or doesn't require a lot from them. But it puts China in a position of global leadership in a magnanimous way. You know, we're supporting this institution that's supposed to help. Help take care of pandemics and deal with other kind of international health problems. At the same time that it can paint the U.S. in a very dim light for having withdrawn from that organization and cut off its funding. This all came about in the context of the WHO agreeing on a new, at least fundamentally agreeing on a new global pandemic framework. I don't think all the details are yet in place, but the idea is to increase the sharing of research and data on new viruses in particular as they crop up so that countries can better prepare for potential pandemics. There's a scheme in place to sort of or being talked about where countries that participate in the research sharing piece of this would be able to have access to a common pool of vaccines and medicines and test kits for any future COVID-like pandemic. Countries would be expected, the countries that are manufacturing these things, the richer countries would be expected to donate a large portion of their products to this common pool so that developing countries could participate as well and basically try to manage the next pandemic a whole lot better than humanity managed COVID. The U.S. is not part of this. So again, it's kind of a big missing piece to any future global framework for dealing with this stuff. But I will say Robert F. Kennedy took time out of his busy schedule to call into the WHO conference where they were debating this and let everybody know there that he thinks they all suck. And that was really kind of him. I'm sure they were sorry that Bobby couldn't be there in person to deliver his message. But it was all very heartwarming.
Yeah, real loss. All right, Derek, let's conclude with this Golden Dome project.
It is the revival, basically, of Star Wars. I mean, we've been down this road before, and people who are nostalgic for the Strategic Defense Initiative of the Reagan years can be pleased to know that Donald Trump has brought it back. He's now calling it the Golden Dome, patterning it after the Iron Dome in Israel. But of course, gold is nice and shiny and valuable, and iron is drab and not at all suitable for Donald Trump and his vision of America. So on Tuesday, he announced a $175 billion program to build the Golden Dome missile defense system, which will rely on a network of satellites and space-based interceptors to target and take down any missile supposedly launched at the United States from anywhere in the world. There's a couple of things, I think, to sort of consider here. One is that it's going to cost way more than $175 billion. I don't know where they're getting this figure from, but there's already estimates of like $500 billion or more. Certainly over the life of this project, it will probably cost more than that. It's going to be a massive outlay of money from the federal government to defense contractors. So, good for those guys. As we always say, they deserve it. But the other thing to consider is that it's not going to work because missile defense doesn't work. It never works. And it works in the margins, but it's never as successful as its proponents claim. And you always find out years after the fact that, remember when we said that Patriot missile batteries shot down every Iraqi Scud during the Gulf War? Well, it turns out they only shot down one. And the rest of them got through. It always gets shit like that. The testing will go forward. There was a piece in Inkstick that I thought was very good this week. People might be interested in reading it. But the testing will go forward, and they'll do these scenarios where they fire dummy projectiles, and then they try to intercept them. They're always rigged. They're always rigged with the dummy projectile kind of electronically identified for the interceptors so they can find it and destroy it efficiently. There was actually a story. I had never heard this before, but apparently the New York Times reported this back in 1993 that during a 1984 missile defense test that was part of the Star Wars program, the engineers who were conducting the test planted a bomb on the target missile so that even if it didn't get hit by an interceptor, it would still blow up. Like, that's the kind of stuff that goes on here. It's wild. It would be really funny if it wasn't about to cost us, you know, $1 trillion or $2 to do this.
So, that's the real joke.
Yeah, that is the real joke, in fact. You're right. But yeah, everybody be on the lookout for the big, glorious Golden Dome. I don't know if he's going to, you know, do anything to, you know, put some gold leaf in the sky somehow so that we all know we're being protected. But I wouldn't put it past him.
Derek, thank you so much for updating. And everyone, thank you for listening. Again, please consider subscribing. And at the level of $60 or more, you get a digital subscription to The Nation magazine. And if you can't do that, please like the pod and review it on Apple. It really does help us. And as always, keep on rocking in the free world. Bye.
Feel like you're stuck in career limbo? Clock in, clock out, repeat. No growth, no new opportunities. It's time to break out and break into tech. With CBT Nuggets, you can start building the IT skills that companies are hiring for right now. We make training fast, simple, and practical. From networking to cybersecurity, you'll get short, easy-to-watch videos and hands-on virtual labs so you can build real-world skills without expensive gear or complicated setups. For just $59 a month, you get unlimited access to our full training library. That includes certifications, skill-based learning, and practice exams, a $100 value included free. Learn anytime, anywhere, and get job ready on your terms. Thousands have used CBT Nuggets to launch new careers, and you can too. Right now, CBT Nuggets is offering a free trial. Easily find the training you need and test it out with no commitment. Start your 7-day free trial now at cbtnuggets.com. Don't wait. A better job is just a few clicks away.
If your brain is at full capacity with to-dos, birthdays, and dinner plans, meet Skylight Calendar. It syncs your entire family schedule onto a sleek digital display, so you focus on important things like where you left your coffee. Right now, Skylight is offering our listeners $30 off their 15-inch calendars by going to skylightcal.com/talk. Go to skylightcal.com/talk for $30 off your 15-inch calendar. That's SKYLIGHTCAL.com/talk.